This is the Anatomy of a Scream Pod Squad Network.
Welcome back to Such Sights to Show and all things Clive Barker podcast. I am Joe Lipsett, and I'm joined as always by Mr. Brian Christopher. Hi, Brian.
Howdy, Joe.
Okay, so as promised slash threatened last time, we are revisiting Books of Blood, this time in singular format. So we're checking out Book of Blood, the 2009 British film directed by John Harrison. And this is kind of the same thing as before. So we're using the framing stories of the Book of Blood as well as On Jerusalem Street from Books of Blood, Volume 1 and 6. Only, I'm going to say it right off the top, Brian, this worked way better for me.
Yeah, honestly, the biggest thing that throws me off with this is just that it's the singular Book of Blood. I keep wanting to say books, but other than that, it is so much more in line with the source material and both by way of narrative, and it does take some liberties with the narrative, and I'm sure we're going to have some things that worked better and worked maybe didn't work so good in terms of how that panned out. But I also just feel like the overall vibe and the tone much better fits with Barker's short stories than the 2020 version.
Yeah. I mean, folks, if you didn't listen to the last episode when we were talking about the 2020 Books of Blood, one of our big challenges with that was how we were introducing a new for that film story, and we just kept sort of revisiting, recycling, returning between the three different stories we were covering. So it felt busy. It felt a little unfocused. We kept drawing negative comparisons to Trick or Treat, and you know, we kind of said, oh, why couldn't they just stick a little bit more closely to the source material because it is pretty rich. And ironically enough, that's when listener Eric Riley stepped in and said, oh, well, you should try this other one. And I think by keeping this relatively straightforward, like, yeah, you're right. I think there are a couple of things here that don't quite work. We're taking a little bit of liberty. Some of these things are more successful than others, but overall, by saying, okay, we've got a pretty solid setup for a film, let's not overcomplicate it, I think this movie comes out far and wide ahead. Is that a saying? I'm just going to say it. It's far and wide ahead.
If it's not, it should be.
Right? Yeah. Okay, so this movie does actually employ a bit of a framing device because we open with the killer for hire who tracks down what we come to realize is Simon, the titular Book of Blood. So he's got all the writing already on his skin, and this man says, yeah, I've been hired by a collector, and I'm more or less here to take the skin off of you. Apologies in advance. And then he throws Simon down on the table, and Simon says, well, before you do a hack job on me, let me tell you my story. And then we flash back, and this is where we get Simon conning Mary. She's a foreign teacher, so she's an American who's living in London, although the film was shot in Scotland. And she essentially falls for Simon and his ruse. So it's very similar to what we're getting in the short stories. And then we kind of deviate when they move into a haunted house and there's like a tortured backstory. But overall, it kind of unfolds sequentially until we get back to the point where, oh yeah, Simon ran away because he couldn't bear to be the storyteller of dead people's histories anymore. And essentially, Mary hired this killer to track him down because she was not done telling their stories.
Oh, so it was her.
That's what I took it to be, because we don't ever see anybody else, and the fact that she knew where to show up at the end.
True. That is true. Okay, that makes sense. Yeah, I do feel like there is some stuff in this that I think is a little vague, and not necessarily in a bad way. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it does leave a little bit of room for interpretation, but I want to kick this off with, I knew immediately, I would say within like the opening frames of this movie that it was going to be more interesting than the 2020 version.
Okay, tell me why.
Just watching Simon eat breakfast was shot in such a disturbing manner. Like the sound disgusting. Design, ooh. the makeup, like
the blood in the eggs.
Oh. The blood in the egg. Yeah, just everything about it was just stomach churning in a way that felt absolutely deliberate. In a way that was just so effective. And you could just already tell, like, okay, this isn't going to be a by-the-numbers sanitized movie the way that the 2020 version was.
Honestly, so many word choices that you just used really reflect my sentiment. You know, this is grotesque. It's uncomfortable. My stomach was turning watching him eat this food. You're right. The Foley work was super, super good. Everything felt down and dirty, and it felt very on the level with Clive Barker. You know, it's not sanitized. It doesn't look pretty and clean like the Hulu version. This looks rough around the edges, but that's very much the vibe we often got from Books of Blood.
Yeah, yeah. It doesn't seem like amateurish, or it doesn't seem that it's not bad filmmaking. It is
not even it dirty. Looks low budget or something. Yeah, this looks good. It's just that we're using an appropriate amount of grime to give you the proper vibe.
Absolutely. Yeah. So yeah, I was just immediately like, okay, I think we might be in good hands with John Harrison, the director, who the name sounded familiar when I looked him up. I don't necessarily know him from his other directing work, but a lot of people probably know him from his composing work because he did the soundtrack for 1982's Creepshow.
Oh, okay. Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, I gathered that he wasn't like a super, super well-known director on this side of the pond. Like, I went into this with a low reputation of this film. You know, I was under the impression people thought this was a bad movie, and that's one of the reasons we don't talk about it. And coming out of it, I don't know why I ever would have thought that. You know, I saw a couple of reviews that say, oh, it's a little bit long for what it's actually doing. And I don't entirely disagree with that. But overall, I was very impressed with Harrison's direction. I think he captures this whole story, the mood, the tone. I just think this movie is actually really, really well done.
Yeah, and he adds enough to make it a feature movie. Yeah, he could have shaved, I think, a few minutes off, but he adds enough backstory and he adds enough meat to the bones that, you know, because these are both very short stories, especially by Clive Barker standards. If I remember correctly, like, I think each was maybe about 10 pages at tops.
Right.
And so there's, you know, they're really just working within the context of the books. It really is just working as a framing device to introduce this idea of these books of blood. Mm-hmm. So to be able to take that, turn it into a feature length script and do it without like watering down or majorly diverting from the themes of the original stories, I think is an accomplishment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I agree. So what did you think of the Simon and Mary relationship in this movie?
It definitely adds the layers of sensuality that, well, now I'm trying to remember. I think in the 2020 version, they did have like, quote unquote, like sexual tension, but
it's so PG.
So flat that it was it wasn't really effective. Here, she's having dreams about like jerking him off.
She's eye-fucking him the minute he walks into her classroom.
Yeah. but it's also got that really Barker flavor of like really uncomfortable about it. Like she knows that this is inappropriate. And when she has that dream about him, like he comes in to check on her in her room afterwards and she can't even look at him. So it's really picking up on that idea of the recesses of our mind where those desires that make us feel really icky and uncomfortable is on display while also like being genuinely sensual. You know, there is extensive nudity in this movie, both from the women and the men. You know, I don't remember the last time I saw a horror movie where you get peen. Like this, it's, you know, you get a little bit of everything here. So Harrison isn't afraid to dive into that Barker sexuality.
Mm-hmm. I'll admit I preferred the chemistry here between Jonas Armstrong and Sophie Ward as Simon and Mary, respectively. Mm-hmm. I found that Armstrong was slightly less convincing as a con artist than his mm-hmm. counterpart in the 2020 film. He seemed to have a little bit more sense of how to play that devilish slyness. Armstrong seems a little young, like a little childish for my liking, but the chemistry here I think is actually better. And yeah, it is helped because we actually get to see them fuck. You know, that nightmare sequence or the dream sequence where she comes in and she can't stop looking at his body, and then he takes her hand and puts mm-hmm. it on his dick mm-hmm. and then we just go into pound town. But it's like, it's hot, it's uncomfortable because you know it's very inappropriate. And to me, it very much did capture the flavor of the kind of sex we were often seeing in Books of Blood. So I thought that this was an excellent, much more adult oriented adaptation choice.
I agree. And I also agree there is the Simon from the 2020 version did pull off like the charming con man a little bit better. But I also think that, again, this was a deliberate choice in Book of Blood. He's a little bit more conflicted. He's not just a con man, because you mm-hmm. do get the sense that when he was younger, I think he really does believe, if nothing else, if not, he actually did have some kind of clairvoyance that then mm-hmm. went away like in his teens. Right. And so you get this kind of this slightly different narrative where, yes, he's coming in as a con man, but then he is starting to realize that there is stuff actually happening, and he's actually mm-hmm. believing that he's behind what's going on. Like, he does believe that whatever powers he had as a kid, you know, whatever motivations he had coming into this, you know, they are actually coming back. And, you know, obviously mm-hmm. we learned that's not the case. And he no. learns that in a very painful manner. But yeah, I think he is purposely not as suave and savvy because he's more conflicted, because he is starting to believe that, you know, maybe something actually is going on here.
Mm-hmm. I think the other reason that the con angle worked better for me in the 2020 version is because of Mary's backstory, where she's mm. grieving the loss of her child and she's so excited about making that connection, which is, of course, how Simon ends up duping his way into her life. Whereas yeah. here, she has a different sort of tragic backstory, which is that she more or less uncovered the work of a serial killer when she was a child, but she didn't inform the police until after this individual had racked up like 6 victims. And mm-hmm. she feels conflicted about how she more or less, you know, inadvertently contributed to this or to these other girls' deaths. And I don't think it works as well here, if only because she seems like a bit of a fool for believing Simon so readily. But also, I did not understand at all. Like, even with the explanation about the charcoal and the gunpowder, those made sense. I did not understand how he would have pulled off this blood fountain image that she saw, unless we are meant to believe that that was just her having a dream.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember now. Like, I don't know that they ever did fully explain that part of it. So yeah, maybe mm-hmm. that was something that was they were really tapping into, because I think they do play well with
what is dream, what is reality. Yeah,
what is dream, what is reality, what is mm-hmm. bullshit, what is legitimate.
Yeah, like that sequence where she ends up getting her face kind of smushed by an invisible figure, and then she's held up in the air and pushed to the window so she can see it. And then we see it again played out on Reg's videotape, and it's just her getting up and walking to the window. Mm-hmm. I really like that sequence.
And they did such a good job at establishing how brutal these ghosts can be. Mm-hmm. So that when you see that hand go over her mouth, like, I'm legit like, yeah. Oh God, what's going to happen here? Cause this could go very badly. Cause oh man, the initial flashback scene they show to that poor teen girl who gets her face ripped clean off.
Holy shitballs.
That was brutal. And
it was super brutal. I didn't like the fact that we more or less opened the movie with a rape. Like, it's implied. We're not seeing a ton, but we definitely see her underwear start to get pulled down. And I was like, oh, I don't know. Is this just going to be disgusting? So I was actually really happy that...
her face got ripped off. Say,
I'm just happy that it was her face that got ripped off instead.
Yeah, yeah.
I do love, though, that we clearly spent a lot of love and money on that effect to the point that we get to see it a second time later on in the film. I was like, you know what? You spent your money. You show it to me a second time because it looked fucking good.
And then, like, the little touch that you see, like, the prosthetic that they have of her ripped off face, you see it start to, like, move a little bit, so you can see she's actually still alive with the face off. It's that was so brutal. And then, you know, the words, don't mock us, on the wall.
Yeah. Whoa. These ghosts are not to be trifled with. They are not just fucking around. Not going to lie, I mean, considering the runtime, I could have taken more ghost stuff. I know it feels like we're kind of saving everything to the end, but you messaged me. I watched this ahead of you, so I think I still had about 30 minutes left in the film when you were just starting it. And you, you know, said, oh my God, we've got Doug Bradley in this movie as Tollington, the original owner of the house who was conducting seances in the attic. And I said, yeah, don't get excited. I think he's only showing up in maybe a flashback or still images. And I'm not going to lie, I was like, I could have done with way more of what else had happened in that house to set the precedent.
Yeah. I think they do spend a little bit too much time kind of with the comings and goings at the house and between between Mary and between Simon. I think they could have delved more into the flashbacks. And I don't know, maybe it was a thing where, you know, you mentioned them putting a lot of their budget into that sequence with the teen girl. Like, maybe they didn't have a whole lot. I do get the sense that, you know, I don't think this had a huge budget, but they did do a good job at making sure that when they could, it does show up on screen. So maybe they only had so much of that to go.
Yeah. And folks, we don't actually know what the production budget of the film is because it's not listed on the Wikipedia page. It also looks like it really didn't play very widely. So I don't know if this was always kind of intended for a physical media drop and that was, you know, where we were going to send it, or if this was a festival circuit and then we were going to do that. But it doesn't really look like this even played outside of the UK, at least not theatrically.
Oh, and I did happen to stumble on, if IMDb is to be believed, it had an estimated $6 million budget.
Okay.
With a worldwide gross of $567,000. So yeah, I don't think this got out very wide.
Which is frustrating, right? Because if you do look near the bottom of this, and I actually meant to go and spend a bit of time on Clive Barker's website to see if he had any additional insights, because it doesn't really look like he was too involved in this, but he did speak at, I want to say, the Fantasia premiere here in Canada, in Montreal. And at the time, that was when they said, oh, and we're actually going to adapt other books of blood, including Dread, which we know does happen. But they also had a couple of other titles that they anticipated coming down the pike. And I wonder if they put their money into these first two films, didn't see the return, and just said, yeah, we're not doing this anymore.
Yeah, it's entirely possible.
And then, you know, we wait 11 years.
It actually is funny, like, during the 2020 episode, I kind of complained about how they had all this rich source material to pull from in terms of, like, all these stories from the books of blood. And it's just, this was kind of a funny discovery for me, the way my brain works, because my brain kept thinking things like, yeah, they really haven't adapted a lot of his books of blood short stories into movies. But I mean, that's not super true, because I was looking, like, in the production that it notes that this book of blood was the seventh story to be adapted, because they've done Rawhead Rex, they've done Candyman, they've done Lord of Illusions. Apparently they did The Body Politic within the 1997 anthology Quicksilver Highway. I think we've mentioned that before.
We did, but neither one of us wanted to go and check it out because,
yeah,
according according to most people, including the Horror Queers Book Club, they said that it was not the strongest.
Gotcha, gotcha. And they've done Midnight Meat Train. So it's not right. It's not that nobody has touched these.
Although, did you see that one of the two other titles that they were thinking about was Pig Blood Blues? Damn it.
Yeah, and then Madonna.
Which is the other one we thought was really adaptable.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it's a shame they never got to them.
Mm-hmm. Especially if it had been up to this caliber, right? Like, I think as we've sort of reiterated a couple of times in this episode, by choosing to focus on just a couple of stories, but to do it well, like, we are fleshing out Mary, we are fleshing out Simon, we're allowing a certain amount of time to pass throughout the course of this film so that it feels like we're telling not just a condensed, very abbreviated story. Like, this has some oomph to it. It has some depth and gravitas so that by the time we get to the Highway of the Dead and the house is the intersection and we get to see all those ghosts writing their stories on Simon's body, it hits reasonably well.
Yeah. Yeah. And they really lean into like the melancholy at the end with some of those shots of the dead walking around. And, you know, you kind of get that, you know, because at this point, I don't think it's a spoiler if you've read the stories or you know, we've talked about the original. You know, Simon does wind up getting killed by the sociopath, and he winds up. I actually think in the book or in the story, we actually find the hitman or assassin or whatever you want to call him. He's the one that winds up on the roads of the dead. But here, we see Simon, and there's that very, I would say, approaching over the top shot of him almost doing like a look into the camera before he like walks off into the
very mournful. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. I liked this ending though. You know, I was uncertain how we were going to do this man's death, but I thought that White Bird drowning in the room full of blood, it ended up coming across particularly well. You know, we get to see the water or the blood level rising. And then I love that smear of his hand across the glass when it's clear that he's not getting out. And then it's just completely done when Mary walks in. And we understand that some time has passed because her hair is now entirely gray. So this is, you know, potentially 20 years, 10 years later. And I was really excited when she pulls up his frankly great looking skin suit out of the suitcase. And we can see that the stories are still being written on the husk. I thought that was a great touch.
Yeah. I really liked that as a visual. I will admit, I don't think I'm fully on board with the direction they went with Mary and her conclusion.
Okay. Why not?
So I actually quite liked in the story how there's an element to which it's both of these people are kind of, if I remember correctly, they're kind of brought closer together by this ordeal. You know, she finds this poor guy just completely covered in these stories on his skin. You know, she feels, if I remember correctly, a sense of responsibility for him to both the stories of the dead, but also to him kind of as their book.
Yeah, here, she's not malicious.
Yeah, here it seems a lot more like it's almost like her Breaking Bad moment where she becomes a lot more opportunistic about it, which they maybe slightly hint at because, you know, she's trying to like make a name in parapsychology or paranormal studies. But it's it just seems too much of a pivot that she kind of takes this guy and spends the next, like, you know, like you said, like 20, maybe 20 plus years just letting him get tortured and making millions of dollars off. I think it would be one thing if, like, they didn't make such a point of talking about how she made millions of dollars off the books that she wrote off of this. You know, if she was willing to do this because she was obsessed with telling the stories of the dead, which, you know, is part of it. But I don't know. There's just something about it that just seems more megalomaniacal in terms of, like, you know, she's got this big mansion and she like daily crucifies him on it so that she can take pictures and, you know, write more of these books that she's making millions off of.
No, see, I love that because I really enjoyed this idea that her own value system was going to be compromised over that lengthy period of time. I think it starts off as that sense of responsibility, and she is going to take their warnings, you know, don't laugh at us, don't mock at us, listen to us. I love the idea that she started almost from a position of virtue, and by the end of it, she has become sort of evil and self-serving and, yes, opportunistic. So I like the idea that she's still willing to follow through on the promise she made to the dead, but that she has let it corrupt her.
I guess I would like that more if we had seen more of a progression, because I'll be honest, I didn't even 100%, like, I saw that her hair was white.
Yeah.
I couldn't 100% tell if that was time passing or if it was meant to show that, like, the ordeal she had been through had, like, whitened her hair. Because, like, they didn't do anything else to age her.
Right.
And so, because we didn't get to see any kind of progression, I think I might be more on board with it the way you are, had they shown time passing and had they shown her starting from a place of, yeah, good intentions, but kind of like letting the self-import over the whole ordeal kind of corrupt her, that would have been, I think, interesting. But I just think because they cut right from, you know,
the writing to the 20 writing years
to,
or something.
Yeah, to the 20 years later. And they weren't exactly clear about the amount of time that had passed. Something seemed missing there. There was a little bit of whiplash for me with that.
Yeah. You know, I can definitely understand that. Thinking back, the second act of the film does feel just a tad saggy, where we're spending a bunch of time with Reg setting up this sort of paranormal activity equipment around the house, and we're having different interactions with specters and stuff. I wonder if we weren't going to spend so much time unpacking the history of the house as we maybe would have liked with the Doug Bradley character or somebody else, I wonder if we could have trim that up a little bit so that we could have had more of an extended epilogue. I think the problem is that the film thinks the ending with the revelation that, oh, that is Simon from the opening, and oh, this is Mary who's coming in. I think they want to treat it as a bit of a twist, so you can't spend a ton of time looking at, you know, oh, it's been 20 years and she's been assaulting me on the daily and, yeah, photographing me and making money off of me and so on. It feels like we need to get over that very quickly so we can get to this, Tales from the Crypt DC comic style.
I do think that's just a trap that sometimes filmmakers will fall into, where they have this vision of kind of like how a sequence is going to go. And sometimes they don't necessarily have the earned path to get to that.
But I mean, honestly, overall, I would say for me, these are still relatively small gripes, because I found this hour and 40 minutes went by relatively smoothly. I was enjoying these performances, as we've talked about, the look, the visual aesthetic of it, even practical effects, like the ghosts look a tiny bit CGI janky, but not in a way that's taking me out of the movie. I actually thought it kind of endeared me to it a little bit.
Yeah, they actually kind of reminded me of kind of some of the same effects that they used in Return of the King with the, like that dead, the undead army. There was kind of a similar vibe there. And I really like the way that looks. That's a really cool visual. So, yeah, I was, again, you know, if we're talking about a $6 million budget, it wasn't going to be seamless. But for the money that they had, it was pretty damn close.
Yeah. So, I don't know. Overall, for me, this is definitely the winner of the two Books of Blood adaptations in terms of the wraparound stories. But I think this is a movie I'm going to try to encourage more people to watch. And maybe this is where we should have one final conversation, Brian. So we watched this second after not having a great experience with the 2020. Do we think that our disappointment in the more contemporary version ended up making this go down a bit easier? Like, are we being a little generous with the 2009 film?
I think it would be naive to say that our positive look on this had nothing to do with how it compares to the 2020 version. But I don't think I would see this. If I had seen this first, I still think I would like this.
Right.
In fact, I almost think the 2020 version would almost suffer even more by watching this one and then seeing what they did with the newer version. I really think I would like this regardless. You know, I think it shines a little bit more in comparison. But yeah, you know, like the complaints I have, like you mentioned, I think are relatively minor quibbles when overall this gets so much right with taking the source material and turning it into something that still has that same spirit and same energy.
Mm-hmm. And really, that is it for me, right? That 2020 version just felt so sanitized. It felt, for the masses, far too mainstream and easy to go down, sanded off all the interesting edges. So even though really we are telling more or less the same story with these same characters, that one just felt made for Hulu. And this one felt... oh, we know Clive Barker. We know how to do this. It's got to have a bit of grit and grind to it. It's not perfect, but you know what? Most things aren't. The spirit of this film is far more accurate to what I would expect in an adaptation of this material.
Yeah, hell, we've talked about over the course of six volumes of Books of Blood, the source material isn't perfect. You know, so to take something and... nailing the spirit of it, but also doing something in Harrison's case to make it his own a little bit without, you know, taking it off on this weird, you know, any kind of like weird or sanitized side tangent, you know, I think is a hell of an accomplishment. Yeah. And I do think I would like this regardless if it was in comparison to another movie.
Right. Okay. Well, before we announce where we're going next, Mr. Brian, if people want to talk to you about either that 2020 film or the 2009 film, how would they get in touch?
You could reach me at Blue Sky at Evil Taylor Hicks or at Instagram at Evil Taylor Hicks. And if people wanted to chat with you about dream hand jobs and naked crucifixions, where do they get a hold of you?
Oh my God. I'm not going to lie. Some of this imagery was quite hot, like very good BDSM fodder. So hats off to adult sexy times in this film. But yes, if folks want to reach me, I can be gotten at B Stole My Remote, and that's the letter B. And of course, we should thank the Anatomy of a Scream Pod Squad Network for hosting the show. Make sure you're listening to the other feeds, the other podcasts. And yeah, Mr. Brian, we're not done. We're actually going to return to the world of Nightbreed, but in a completely different format. So we're going to go and check out Clive Barker's Nightbreed Archive Volume 1. So we're hitting the world of comics again, and we're going to hopefully have a better time than Midian Unmade.
Yeah, and honestly, I am cautiously optimistic that we will. I feel like doing this on a more visual medium, I think, is going to be helpful for something like the World of Midian. So I hold out hope that this is going to be a better experience than Midian Unmade was.
Yeah, we shall see. But folks, that's where we're headed next time. So get reading that comic, and we will talk to you soon.
Squad.